So we're going to continue and wrap up the discussion of deep inelastic scattering. I just remind you where we left off yesterday. We computed the what's called the parton level cross section, which is just the cross section for elastic scattering off of, from electrons on quarks. And we argued by virtue of the fact of factorization that we can compute scattering from hadronic initial and final states in terms of these parton level cross sections with a suitable modification, which we'll discuss in a second. So we computed the thing that's easy to compute, which is this parton level scattering cross section, which you can just do using the Feynman rules of QED. So here we go. We have the scattering cross section for at the quark level. And what we want to do next is try to embed this into the hadronic level. So how do we go from a quark level scattering process to the hadronic level scattering process? So we need to remind ourselves what the variables are. All of the definitions are going to be basically the same as what we already wrote down. So we have little p, which is, or little p prime, is the form momentum of the initial or final quark. And we had big P, which is the form momentum of the initial hadron. So what we want to do is ask, how do we relate little p and big p? In some sense, you can think of little p as carrying some fraction of the total momentum of big P, the total momentum of the proton. So Q that interacts with the photon carries a fraction, which we'll call a little x, of the total momentum. So we can write a little p as being equal to x times big P. And it's a little subtle how this is defined. If the proton is at rest, then this formula doesn't really make too much sense. But in the sense that the proton is also moving relativistically, then you can write this down in a rigorous way. So this fraction little x will take values between 0 and 1. So now let's solve for x. Oh, I also should remember that the variable q squared, which was minus capital Q squared, which was L minus L prime squared, this variable is the same, whether I'm talking about parton level or hadronic level, of course, since the lepton part of the diagram is always the same. All right, so let's solve for x. So let me use momentum conservation at the parton level. So I have little p prime squared, which is equal to 0. Since the final state quark, I'm assuming, is massless. And so this is little p plus L minus L prime squared. And so I can write this as p plus q quantity squared. And so I have little p dotted into q. Do I need a factor of 2? I think I do. For some reason, I don't have that. Plus q squared. All right. And so this is simply 2x times big P dotted into Q plus Q squared, and all of that is equal to 0. So now I can solve this equation for x, and I get that x is equal to minus Q squared over 2 big P dot x dot Q, or Q squared over 2 big P dot Q. So this is exactly Bjorkane x that we put in before. Previously, we defined x as sort of a measure of the inelasticity of the collision, but it also has this interpretation where it's the fraction of the proton momentum that the struck quark carries. So lastly, we want to relate S hat to big S. So S hat is the parton level center of mass energy squared. So this will be L plus little p squared. And since everything is massless here, yeah?
What's big P here? Is it like scalar? Or?
No, I wrote it above. So it's the same big P as we defined before. It's the momentum of the proton in the initial state at the hadron level.
The momentum is a four momentum.
Why, yeah, these are all four momenta.
Why would small p and big P be related by a number?
Yeah.
If my proton is flying to the right, my gluon, like my partons can still fly to another direction. So it's two zero, then
this is what I mean. It's not obvious this is true. If you thought about this in the rest frame, it's obviously false. So if you're in the proton's rest frame, this would just be MP 000. And in no sense is the quark, and the quark is supposed to be massless, right? So it's not satisfied in the proton's rest frame. But in a frame in which the proton is boosted, sorry?
The quark is massless?
We're assuming that it's massless. It's a reasonable approximation. Okay? The masses are very light compared to the energies we're talking about.
So that equation is not true. It doesn't exist in x such that that's true. Why are you assuming so?
No, it's true in an approximate sense. In a frame in which the proton is moving relativistically, then you can write this down. So in a boosted frame, you can write it down. It's true in that sense.
You're like already breaking Lorentz invariants and everything.
No, we're not.
Well, in a sense, we are. We're making an assumption, which is like some kind of decent in some frames, but definitely not in all of them.
Yeah, so we started out motivating the problem in a kinematic range in which the center of mass energy squared is much larger, the center of mass energy is much larger than the proton mass. So energies involved are much larger than the proton mass. So if you work in the center of mass frame for the collision, then you can write this down. It's fine. Because everything's massless in that frame. OK, I think you're still troubled, but let me continue on. All right, so what I want to write down is relate the parton level center of mass energy squared, S hat, to the total center of mass energy squared for the hadron level collision, which was just S. So this was L plus P squared. Since the electron and the quark are assumed to be massless, this is just 2 L dot little p. So this is 2 times X L dot big P. So 2 L dot big P is S. And then I multiply by x. Since again, I'm assuming that the square root of s is much, much larger than mp. OK. So here's how those two things are related to each other. And then lastly, I need one other thing, which is I need to consider the variable y.
Can
which was big P dot Q over big P dot L. And so this is equal to a little p dot Q over a little p dot L. Let's see, why is that true? Ah, because if I relate big P to little p, I get a factor of x, and then I get another factor of, I guess, 1 over x, and those will just cancel out. Okay. Okay. So now Q is P minus P prime, P prime minus P. And this is P dot L. So P dotted into P will give us 0. And so this is P dotted into P prime, and then P dotted into L. So this object is minus T hat divided by S hat. So if I just write in factors of 2 here, you can see that this is minus t hat, and this is s hat. OK. So now I can also relate t hat to these other variables that I've defined before. So t hat is equal to s hat times y with a minus sign, or minus s x y. So here's how to relate t hat to the hadron level variables. And then also I have to have u hat as well. So u hat is equal to minus s hat minus t hat, because we're assuming electron and quark are massless. And so this is minus s x 1 minus y. The sx is s hat, and the sxy is t hat. OK, so the motivation for writing down all of these different formulae is just to be able to express the parton level cross-section in terms of variables for the hadron level cross-section. So what I had written down before, d sigma hat by dt hat, let's see if I can. Remember what it is. This was 2 pi alpha squared qq squared over s hat squared t hat squared s hat squared plus u hat squared. And what I'm going to compute is, to start with, is I'm just going to perform a change of variables to write it as d sigma d hat dy. And so this is just d sigma hat dt hat times the Jacobian, which is dt hat dy. So I just take this and I multiply it by the Jacobian factor. So that's just s times x. Right. S times x times y. No, do you, yeah, sorry. Just s times x.
Why is there an absolute value there?
Because it'll be negative.
No, but like, that's not the chain rule. Chain rule doesn't say write it like that with an absolute value.
Yeah.
The two answers are different, but why do you pick this one?
Yeah, so, okay. So the reason is, so if I think about it like this, so what I wrote before, d sigma by dt, so I'd want to think about it like this. Like that? OK. So if I want to rewrite this as dy, d sigma hat by dy hat, And so this would be dy d sigma hat by dt hat by dy. Because one of these things is, so dt, because there's a relative minus sign here, you end up having to flip the limits of integration. And so that gives you an extra minus sign for both cases. Yeah? Okay.
It just sounds like you're saying that in general the chain rule is wrong.
No, of course I'm not saying that.
No, but why not? Like, what you're saying here is that usually in a chain rule you would just write it without the absolute value, right?
And it I want to think of it as the Jacobian, right? So you have to take this, you take the magnitude, right, when you compute the Jacobian. I think that's right? Is it not?
And I don't see why this is different from just using the chain rule.
Yes.
I have just a derivative there, so I can just write it out with a chain rule, right?
Yeah, I'm writing it like this to make it clear that what we're really talking about is Jacobian. And the Jacobian...
You have a different reasoning where there's an absolute value, but why is the first one wrong?
Why is the first one wrong? I'm not exactly sure. This is the sense in which I want to compute it. So you want to think of this factor as a Jacobian. You're doing an integral, ultimately. Okay, let me move on. This is calculus. Let's see. I want to write out the formula for d sigma hat dy. So let me plug in here. So I have s hat squared, and then I have t hat squared is q to the fourth. So I'll just write q to the fourth there. And then I have s hat squared, and then u hat squared is s hat squared 1 minus y squared, using the definition that's over there on the left. Okay, so these things will cancel out. And this stuff in parentheses will be 1 minus 2 minus 2y plus y squared. And so I'm going to rewrite this as y squared plus 2, 1 minus y. So then this whole thing is 2 pi alpha squared qq squared over q to the fourth y squared plus 2, 1 minus y. OK. So there we go. All right, so that's the parton level cross-section. And again, we're going to embed this into the hadronic level cross-section. So let's see. So what we need to include, if you remember, when we wrote down what is the hadronic level cross-section, it factorized into three terms. The middle term was the parton level cross-section, which we just wrote down. The last term was the probability to hadronize to a given hadronic final state. And by summing over all possible hadronic final states, that's simplified, and we just could set that factor equal to 1. But we also need to include what is the initial factor, the first factor, which is the probability of finding a given quark in the proton with a given momentum little p. So we can write this in the following way. So the probability
of finding quark U. With momentum p, I don't have to write it in terms of little p. I could also write it in terms of x. So I could say, what is the probability of finding a quark q with momentum fraction x, or I should say, the momentum fraction between x and x plus dx, since x is a continuous variable. It's given by the following function. So I'll write it as f sub q as a function of x, and then times a measure dx. So again, we're in a sense just parameterizing our ignorance here. All right. So we have some function. Depends on which quark you're talking about. It also depends on which hadron you're talking about. Here we're just talking about the proton. And it's a function of the momentum fraction x. So this function, fq of x, is called a parton distribution function. Also known as a PDF. And you can think of it as the wave function squared for a given quark inside of the proton. These PDFs will end up playing a very important role. If you want to calculate anything in collider physics involving hadrons, you need to know these PDFs. So now we can write down the total cross-section. So sigma for scattering off of the proton. So I have the hadron, the parton level cross-section. And then I just need to do the sum over all possible quarks and over all possible momenta with the probability of finding that quark with a given momentum, like this. So the sum over momenta is just integrating over this fraction x from 0 to 1. And then I need to sum over all of the quarks in the proton. You can also write this as a doubly differential cross-section, which is d sigma ep to ex dx dy will just be the sum over q fq of x times d sigma hat dy. So this is the doubly differential cross-section. This is exactly the same quantity that we computed before. So before we talked about the parton model, we computed this exactly this quantity, d sigma, I should say this should be d squared sigma, dx dy, as a function of our unknown unknowns, w1 and w2. And so ultimately, we're going to compare that form to this form. But let's talk first about what these PDFs mean, and just to get a sense, an intuitive sense of what they look like. All right, so what I want to know is basically what's the probability of having a given quark inside of the proton with a given momentum fraction x. And so you could start out by asking, what quarks are there inside of the proton? And you might say, well, the proton is a U quark, and a D quark. But of course, that's way too simplistic. So that's kind of the answer that you might tell your grandma, but OK, that's not actually true. U, U, and D are what are known as the valence quarks. But the answer is a little more complicated. So if you imagine a proton, which let's say started out as a U, U, and D quarks, and they were propagating along, just due to the strong interaction, you can fluctuate out of the vacuum QQ bar pairs, which can then annihilate. And so you can have a gluon interaction, which forms a QQ bar pair. So let's say I've got like a U and a U bar here, and then they annihilate again. Or you can have other gluons getting exchanged between the different lines. Or you can fluctuate into existence other types of quarks as well, such as strange quarks, an SS bar pair, for example. So when your high-energy photon from the electron beam scatters off of a quark inside of the proton, it can scatter off of one of the valence quarks, or it can scatter off of one of these QQ bar pairs, which are known as C quarks. And there's no way to tell if you scatter off of a U quark whether it was a valence quark or a C quark that just happened to have the same flavor, all right? Because they're indistinguishable. So for a photon, it can scatter off of any parton, any quark or antiquark in the proton that carries electric charge. The gluon is also a parton in the proton. Of course, the photon cannot scatter off of a gluon. But if you consider the interactions of two protons getting smashed together, then you need to take into account also the gluon PDFs, because two gluons from the two protons can scatter off of one another. All right, so, so the gluon also have a PDF, and this is known as F sub G. And it carries a given momentum fraction x as well. So these PDFs can be measured experimentally. And the way that they are measured experimentally is by measuring exactly this process and measuring how it depends on x. And so here's what they look like, just to give you a little bit of a sense of what the measurement is. So as a function of x, and what's plotted usually is x times f of x for a given species I, let's say. And so here is 1, here is 0.5, and this is meant to be a log scale on the bottom axis. And so we'll plot it between 1, 0.1, 0.01, and let's say 0.001. All right, so I'll just try to sketch what these things look like. So here's the U PDF. Here's the D PDF. This is meant to be U, this is meant to be D. Then we have this is D bar. And I think right below it is U bar. And then this line here will be the S, which is the same as the S bar. There's the charm, which is the same as the charm bar. And then also B, which is equal to B bar. I guess even in principle, the top quark will have a PDF, but I think it's not been measured experimentally. But here we go. So even quarks that are very heavy can be found inside of the proton, even the bottom quark, which is much heavier than the proton. Oh, there's also the gluon, which looks something like this. So at very low momentum fraction, most of the momentum is carried by the gluons. But then you have U and D being the dominant quarks inside of the proton due to the valence quark contributions. Yeah.
So here at the end, you are summing over just the valence quarks, or over all the
quarks? Yeah, right. So this sum goes over quarks, all quarks, and antiquarks. Okay, so.
And also, we are assuming that we cannot like scatter the photon with a top quark.
No, in principle, you need to put it in. So.
But then the assumption that the mass is negligible is not going to be true anymore.
Yeah. To be honest, I don't know exactly how that works. What I do know is that the top quark PDF is very, very small, unless you're talking about at very high energies. These PDFs also depend on S to some extent. But at energies of the LHC, even at those energies, the top quark PDF ends up being very small.
How exactly are they distinguished
between
different quarks?
So what they need to do is actually look at exclusive final states. So you know that you've hit a strange quark, for example, if you produce a state in a final state that involves some strangeness, for example.
If you hit a strange quark, there's no probability of it just like, I don't know, interacting with an up quark, giving its energy away again and disappearing again or something.
So that would be a weak interaction. Probably not in that case. So it's more complicated than what I just described. So you have to worry about all of the different processes that can contribute to producing final states with strangeness, and then you have to try to tease out what's the underlying strange PDF. So it's a complicated business that I don't know the details of too well. All right. So here's the doubly differential cross section. And I just want to plug in what we had before for d sigma hat dy and just evaluate this. What we have is, let's see. Right. So this whole thing, using the expression that we had before, is just the sum over q, x, fq of x, times 2 pi alpha squared, qq squared, times s, over q to the fourth. And then we have y squared plus 2, 1 minus y. So I can write this in a slightly different form to make contact with the formula that we had earlier. So d sigma dx dy, dp to dx. So this is 2 pi alpha squared s over q to the fourth. And then we have these two functions, which ultimately we defined as f1e of x times x y squared, plus 2 of e of x times 1 minus y. like so. So now we can read off exactly what these functions are in terms of the PDFs. So we have f1 e of x times x is equal to the sum over quarks x q the charge squared fq of x. All right, and f2e of x is also just equal to that. So the factor of x gets absorbed, and so this whole thing is also just equal to f2e of x, like so. So just to be a little more explicit, let me just expand all of this out. This is x, and then for the up quark, this will be 2/3 squared fu of x plus x 2/3 squared fu bar of x plus x times minus 1/3 squared. So this should be minus 2/3 squared fd of x plus x 1/3 squared fd bar of x. And then for the strange quark, you have fx times minus 1/3 squared fs of x plus x times 1/3 squared fs of x, et cetera. OK, so this is kind of the end result, that when we started out computing the hadron-level cross-section, we didn't know anything about these functions. Now we do know something more. Yeah?
So I have a question about something. There, the left-hand side is something you can actually measure, right?
Yeah.
And then the right-hand side contains multiple functions. There's fg of x, which apparently, somehow, you can actually figure out and make a plot of
fq of x.
You can make a picture of fg of x.
Yeah, this is fq, so this is only the PDF for the quarks contributes, because only those carry electric charge.
But each of these functions is multiplied by d sigma dy, and mm-hmm. d sigma dy contains functions also of x, which you don't know.
Right.
So how can you figure out how f q depends on x?
Yeah, right. So you have, all of these things are things that you know. So once you specified the kinematics of the initial state and the outgoing kinematics of the lepton, you know everything over here.
But in the calculation we did yesterday, that was that sigma, right? And that sigma still depended on the two functions, the f1 and the f2.
Yeah, so, right. So the question is, how do you disentangle F1 and F2? Because you have, right, so when I write it like this, there's only one unknown function. But now when I write it in terms of F1 and F2, let me rewrite what that expression was.
You have two factors there, and doesn't the second factor itself contain two unknown functions?
So what I wrote here, it does not. What I wrote here does not. There's only one unknown function.
Yeah, I don't understand where that equation comes from.
Ah.
You substituted d sigma dy with something that's completely known.
Yeah, so
we're doing the calculation two ways.
One, when we did just the hadron-level cross-section, assuming that we know nothing, we arrived at a cross-section in terms of two unknown functions. Now we repeated exactly the same calculation using the parton model, assuming that we're scattering off of quarks. Then those unknown functions are actually not independent at all. So they're actually related through this equation here. F2 is equal to x times f1. So there's actually only one unknown function, and it's just given in terms of the PDFs.
So you're saying that what we did today is the same calculation as what we did yesterday, but what we did yesterday was a QED calculation.
No, it's the same as what we did at the beginning of yesterday and the day before, the hadron-level calculation. Yeah.
Okay. Let me. I'm almost done with the punchline. So let me
finish up. So what we had before. We derive e squared sigma dx dy for ep to ex. This was 2 pi alpha squared s over u to the fourth. And then we had our two unknown functions, f1 e of x q squared times x y squared. And then we had 2 F2e x of x and q squared times 1 minus y. So this is what we derived from the formula involving W1 and W2, assuming that we know nothing about partons. This was completely general. And I argued before that even though you have two unknown functions that you want to disentangle, you can't, due to the kinematics. So if you're looking at events where y is close to 1, then you would be disentangling f1. And if you're looking at events where y is close to 0, the momentum transfer fraction is close to 0, then you're teasing out f2. So that's the way in which you can use the kinematics to disentangle one complicated object in terms of these two functions. But in general, they have to depend on both two kinematic variables, x and q squared, in this case, all right? But now we computed, using the parton model, what these functions are. So they're just given by this. So not only are the two functions not independent, they don't depend on two kinematic variables. They only depend on one, just x. So there's no q squared dependence to f1 and f2. So this is the prediction from the parton model. And what we just assumed is that the proton is made of spin 1/2 quarks. We have the given charge. And we arrived on two facts. So F1 and F2. Only depends on x and not on q squared. So this fact is known as Bjorkane scaling. So if you measure these functions at different values of q squared, they're going to be the same. They're only going to depend on x. And so the reason for this is that for an inelastic process, in general, you do have functions that depend on two kinematic variables. But when you look at the parton level scattering, it is an elastic process, right? And so that is telling you that ultimately, there's only one kinematic variable which is important, which you can take to be x. OK? This is only true at lowest order in the strong interaction coupling. Here we just worked at zeroth order. It's only true at zeroth order in alpha s. If you compute corrections at order alpha s, you can compute violations of Bjorkane scaling, but it's computable in a systematic way, and so that's another prediction from QCD. The second thing that we showed is that we have this relation between f1 and f2, which is just that f1e of x is equal to f2e of x. And so this goes under the name of the Callan Gross relation. Okay. So these are the predictions. So we started out asking, how do we know that hadrons are made out of quarks? Well, we can measure these two functions in deep inelastic scattering, and the quark, the parton model, makes these predictions. And so you can test these things. And so experiments done at SLAC in the, I guess, the late 60s, early 70s, tested exactly what I wrote here, and they discovered that, lo and behold, it was an agreement. Okay, so that's all. I just note the fact that we assumed that the partons were spin 1/2. If you made a different assumption, like spin 0 quarks, making up the proton, then you would get a different answer. And so that's going to be a homework problem for you guys to work out. Okay, so that's the story of deep inelastic scattering. All right, so so the next topic that we're going to move on to, which we'll start tomorrow, is going to be the Higgs. So the Higgs is very exciting. We're going to talk about Higgs decays and Higgs production, and we're going to compute these different processes. But so just to set the stage, I just want to discuss a little bit about the historical setup and talk about kind of the road that we collectively have been on to discover the Higgs boson and understand the details of spontaneous symmetry breaking and the weak interaction. So this will just be a brief history of the weak interaction. So the beginning of the problem came a very long time ago, over 100 years ago, when radioactive beta decay. Was discovered. By Becquerel. And okay, so what was observed? You have some nucleus which emits a beta ray, I guess it was called, which is just an electron. But it was realized several decades later that this process is problematic because it violates energy conservation. And it also violates angular momentum conservation. So of course, Pauli proposed that there must exist another particle that gets emitted in radioactive decay in order to preserve energy and angular momentum conservation. So that is the neutrino, or as we know it now, the antineutrino. So a few years later, Fermi wrote down the first interaction for the weak interaction. The first particle physics theory of the weak interaction, which is just a four fermion theory, where you have a neutron turning into a proton by interacting with the neutrino and the electron, like this. So this was Fermi's theory of the weak interaction. But it was unknown what the structure of this interaction was. What are the Dirac matrices that you would put in? People didn't know. All right. So, the next big leap forward came in 1956, when it was hypothesized that the weak interaction may violate parity. And so it was proposed, this idea was proposed officially by Li and Yang, but they were following a suggestion by an experimentalist, Martin Bloch. And so immediately, one of Li and Yang's colleagues, C.S. Wu, set out to measure whether or not parity was violated in the weak interaction. And so it was observed that this was in fact the case. And so the measurement that was done, it was looking at polarized cobalt 60. In this case, let's say the spin of the cobalt was polarized to be pointing down like this. And preferentially, the electrons that came out of this radioactive decay would be pointing anti-aligned with the spin. So it just means that the electrons would came out in this direction over here. So here's the momentum of the electron. So, of course, if you just dot them together, the momentum of the electron dotted into the polarization vector of the cobalt, this operator, or this object, flips sign under parity. So if parity is conserved, it should be zero. But it was observed that this should be negative on average. So this necessitates the existence of chiral couplings to fermions in order to break parity. It requires that the four fermion theory must be chiral to violate parity. And so there was a, yeah?
Doesn't spin flip under parity?
No, it does not. Does not. Yeah. Yeah. So a spin you can think of as like R cross P. If R and P both flip sign under parity, then spin does not. So there was kind of a quest of analyzing a wealth of experimental data for various types of radioactive decay. Muon decay and other types of radioactive decay of nuclei, neutron decay, to figure out what is the correct chiral structure of the weak interaction. So this was the correct structure. Of the weak interaction was this V minus A cross V minus A. Ultimately, this was the only choice that was consistent with the data. And it turned out it was actually only consistent with most of the data. They had to assume that some of the data was in fact wrong, which turned out to be the case in order for this to work. So this was done by Marshak, Sudarshan, and then it's more well known to be done by Feynman and Gell-Mann. So we figured out what the correct structure of the weak interaction is. What is the underlying physics behind this effective interaction? This came from the introduction of the standard model. So this came in around the 1960s, the standard model was proposed by Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg. And it included something that we know today called the Higgs mechanism, which was originally proposed by Higgs, Prout, Englert, Guralnik, Hagen, and Kibble. And even they were originally following work done originally by Anderson on the topic of spontaneous symmetry breaking in condensed matter systems. Okay, so all of this was in the 60s, early 60s. This 1963 and 64. Okay, so this was built in to Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg's proposal for the standard model. And the standard model predicts that the weak interaction is due to gauge interactions. Massive gauge bosons, in particular for beta decay, due to the W boson. So the prediction is that you have these additional heavy gauge bosons, and if they're mediating interactions, why not just produce them and discover them themselves? You need very high energies, and then ultimately they were discovered. At CERN in 1983. But people, of course, realized why you needed the Higgs to generate masses for these massive gauge bosons. If you don't have them, you run into problems, which you discussed at the very beginning of the class. In order to write down a consistent theory, you need spontaneous symmetry breaking to give mass to these states. So the prediction was that there should be something else, which is the Higgs. And so for a long time, people predicted that it should be right around the corner. Many decades go by, it's right around the corner. Then finally, 2012, it was also discovered. In 2012, also at CERN. Okay, so, so when you write it out like this, let's see if we can get the whole timeline on one board. So when you think about it like this, really the Higgs boson is the culmination of over 100 years of effort in trying to understand the origin of radioactive decay and writing down a consistent theory to describe this phenomenon. Okay, so that's it for today. And then tomorrow, we're going to discuss the Higgs properties and its decay.